Alright. So essentially we got here last time. And you may remember we were doing finite element methods, and we had taken a general we were doing this in two dimensions, which we'd broken up into triangles. And we did essentially a trapezoidal rule, which is a linear approximation, which was expressed in terms of the values of the unknown phi at the vertices of the triangle. We claimed that the value of this integral f, which is grad phi squared, half grad phi squared, was this form here, which is a quadratic form in terms of the values of phi and these cotangents of the angles of the triangle. Alright. So if we took a general domain, we would just divide it up into some set of triangles. As we'll see, there are going to be some rules about triangles, because it's not going to work unless the triangles have a nice shape. They can't be too long and skinny, or tall and thin. They've got to be sort of decent sizes. Sort of reasonably equal sides. What you now do with these set of triangles is straightforward. You write down this integral. I mean, the total integral is the sum of the triangles. It's written down a single triangle. Therefore, the total integral is just the sum over over the contribution of each triangle. Each triangle is a quadratic form in terms of the vertices. If I sum everything up, I will still get a quadratic form where there'll be replication. I mean, where you'll get more than one contribution to a given term, because triangles share vertex points. So this nodal point dotted into the value of phi here would appear in this triangle and that triangle. So the total result is, previously we got this form phi transpose matrix phi for a triangle where the matrix is 3 by 3. Now we get phi transpose S of phi, where phi is now the vector of all nodal points, and the matrix S is gotten by summing up all the little 3 by 3 matrices. S is called a stiffness matrix, which shows you that this comes from engineering, because presumably it comes from studying the stiffness of things, if I assume it does. I might be wrong there. And S is going to be a sparse matrix, because S will only be non-zero if two values of phi are in a triangle, because the indices of S are labeled by these nodal points. So that nodal point is linked to that one, but it is not linked, say, to that one. So almost all the elements of S are zero, which was the same thing we found with finite difference. Indeed, the only parts of S that are non-zero do correspond to values of phi which are near each other. So you have, because these are small triangles and values of phi are only linked if they're part of a triangle, for the trapezoidal rule to be accurate, then we must have a small triangle, and that means that they're only linked if they're part of a small triangle, which means they must be near each other geometrically. So finite elements share the standard G geometrical structure of finite differences. It's a theory, the formalism that's local. It's got nearest neighbor only. Well, nearby, I should say nearby neighbors. So you can easily, for this simple case, write down the formula for the stiffness matrix element. And for instance, if you have two points I and J here, you will find that Sij is minus cotangent of this angle plus cotangent of that angle. So it is a sum of two terms. You will find that, so that's the off-diagonal term. That's when there's non-zero. The diagonal term, like here, you essentially get contributions from any triangle which has a vertex at I, and if you look at that 3x3 formula, it's just cotangent of this plus cotangent of that plus that plus that plus the cotangents of any angles which are triangles which have a vertex sticking here. Of course, real problems aren't Laplace's equation, so this simple form is only true for Laplace's equation. Alright. So what we've shown is that this integral of f of E can be written in this matrix form or in component form, the sum of I and J, Cj, Sji, Sji, Ci with a factor of a quarter. And we know that f is meant to be a minimum for arbitrary variations of phi, satisfying that the change is zero on the boundary. So in order to find out what that means, we just differentiate f with respect to phi, or equivalently, we let c go to phi plus eta, keep the linear terms in eta and force the linear terms to be zero. The linear terms are just half the sum over ij, eta j, sij, phi. Notice in this simple case, s is symmetric. And this formula for the change in f will only be zero for arbitrary eta if and only if, as this is an arbitrary vector eta, the vector it's dotted into has to be zero, so you just get the sum over I, Sij, phi I equals naught. So, now, the way I've written it, that phi includes the boundary values. If I separated out the boundary values, I'd find a right-hand side. That's done here. So this form is, again, exactly the same mathematically, in essence, as finite difference. It's a sparse matrix dotted into the values of points at a grid. Here the grid is irregular because the grid is the vertices of the triangle, equals some values which are known from boundary values. And the matrix S is only non-zero when the nodal points of the vector indices are near each other geometrically. So the end of this exercise is that we conveniently extended our general regular grid to a relatively arbitrary irregular grid and given a methodology for calculating the form of the matrix, the corresponding matrix. Alright. So, this just sort of summarizes things we've said already. Remember, these triangles are called elements. The vertices of triangles are called nodal points. If you read the finite element literature, they're also called nodes. We don't call them nodes, because in parallel computing you call the processes of the parallel machine nodes, so that runs into confusion. So we call them nodal points to avoid that confusion. There is if you read the literature of finite elements, they'll talk about the assembly of the stiffness matrix. So the assembly of the stiffness matrix is called calculating S from the contributions of the triangle. There's a little difference in finite difference. In finite difference, you essentially generate a single matrix element from the differencing scheme. In finite elements, you have a bunch of triangles. Each of those triangles contributes to a matrix element. So it just happens to be the way the computation is organized. So finite elements are characterized by having each matrix element a sum over contributions, which is not true in the finite difference, because effectively that sum over contributions in finite difference corresponds to writing down the formula for the differential. All this foil says is that there is some nifty applied mathematics which you can use again in simple cases to ensure that the matrix is reasonable, so the S. So what this, I should have another picture here. So what the condition says is that you need to have triangles like that, and you're not meant to have triangles like that or like that. So the triangles are meant to have a decent, have a reasonable shape. They don't have to be 60 degrees. In this particular case, the claim condition is that the sum of these two angles is less than or equal to 180 degrees, where they share an edge, which is certainly satisfied if both are 60, but it's also satisfied if both are 90. So it says they've got to have some sort of reasonable range of angles. And that's a sort of intuitively reasonable, because this is a very unreasonable triangle if you ever thought about it from finite differences, because this is a huge range of distance. So it's not a very plausible triangle to have. So this is some relevance because you may remember in computational fluid dynamics, the small viscosity said that you actually got boundary layers, which if you weren't careful would generate triangles like that, because they said there was a vertical, if you go away from an aircraft, everything changes very quickly in the direction perpendicular to the aircraft because of the small viscosity. So that says that finite elements can be used to deal with irregular geometries, but it's not a universal panacea. You have to be careful in the choice of your triangles to get matrices which lead to convergent iterative schemes. I mean, this condition here, which is sufficient but not necessary to guarantee convergence, says that the diagonal element is greater than or equal to the sum of the off-diagonal elements, modulus thereof. So this will guarantee convergence of simple iterative schemes. And you will notice it was true for the simple finite difference, because in the case of finite difference, in two dimensions, a given matrix had 1 on the diagonal, minus quarter on 4 off diagonals. So for the simple Laplace equation, a typical case this is actually satisfied with an inequality, because you had one on the diagonal, four 1/4 on the off diagonals, that gave you exact equality. There were going to be a few rows where actually was a true inequality, because if one of the elements was a boundary value element, you would lose that 1/4. So in the case of the finite difference, this condition here is equal for all internal points, and it's an actual inequality with the diagonal element being dominant for any points near the boundary, where you'll lose 1/4 because it's a boundary value point. Alright. So we're now going to, so we that sort of ends our potted discussion of finite elements, which obviously does not go into any of the real complications you would need to solve a real problem. So what we're going to do now is an equally abbreviated or obscure discussion, or incomplete, I should say, discussion of conjugate gradients. Now, all right. So what we've shown with this discussion of finite elements is that the solution of our differential equation is equivalent to minimizing a quadratic form. And we've now changed notations. The matrix S has become a matrix A. The vector phi has become a vector X. I've separated out the right-hand sides, which come from the boundary values in the previous formulation. And so the thing to be minimized is a quadratic form where we put a half, not a quarter. A half x transpose ax minus the boundary value term, which is x transpose b or b transpose x, which are the same things. We effectively minimize that already by letting phi go to phi plus eta. We can minimize this here in a trivial way by differentiating with respect to x. If we differentiate with respect to x, we find df dx is x squared, which gets rid of that 2, so you just get ax minus b. And so this is a minimum or a stationary, and it will be obviously a minimum if a is quadratic, if a is positive definite. That will have a minimum at with a solution ax equals b. So that shows you that any equation of the form ax equals b can be thought of as as equivalent to a minimization of a quadratic form, a half x transpose ax minus x transpose b. So you can get this equivalence in several ways. We did the equivalence by converting the differential equation del squared phi equals naught to a variational principle and then discretized it. Here we show that actually even more easily we can take any matrix equation and convert it into a minimization principle. It is required that A be positive definite for it to be a minimum, because if it was not positive definite, then it would not be a minimum. Alright. So we're going to give some sort of hand-waving justification of the conjugate gradient by effectively going through the world's simplest way of doing minimization. which I guess I won't have time to discuss otherwise this semester. Alright. So, we're going to motivate conjugate gradients by doing a simple case which will be called the method of steepest descent, and show how you get a set of equations of the method of steepest descent which are effectively the first iteration of the conjugate gradient method, and then we'll discuss in a hand-waving fashion why you need to set up the following iterations in the way the conjugate gradient does it. Alright. So, one of the key ideas in minimization, which is the same thing as optimization, is that it's pretty hard to minimize a function of more than one variable, but it's pretty easy to minimize a function of one variable. Because you can sort of draw a curve and see what the minimum is. And so a lot of methods for minimizing a function of many variables reduce it to the problem of minimizing a function of one variable. So a good way of doing that is to say, all right, we want to minimize f, this function of a vector x, and we're not clever enough, or we know it's too hard to minimize it directly as a function of all components of x. What we'll do is, we could minimize it one component at a time, but that would be a bad idea. That will essentially give you Jacobi-like methods. We want to get a better method. And so what we're going to do is we're going to write the k plus one guess at x to be the kth guess at x plus a number alpha, which is unknown, times a fixed vector, which, where in the general conjugate gradient we choose in some complex fashion. Here we're going to choose it to be the vector r of k. And what is the vector of r of k? So r of k is just df dx, which is b minus a of x of k, and we call it r of k because b minus a of x of k is just how far we are away from the solution, because we want to solve ax equals b. By definition, b minus a of x of k is the kth residual. So normally we try to draw a picture here. So f is a quadratic form. So in today's internet technology, we should have a nifty VRML applet, which we now, or Java applet, which we will invoke to illustrate this. But I haven't thought of doing that yet. I just thought of it, so we'll do that later on. So normally I have to do it this way. So everybody knows about minimization in two dimensions with two variables, x1 and x2, because it's what you do when you go up and down hills and through valleys. Because if you think about the Earth, we can think of x1 and x2 as just x and y, the horizontal position on the Earth, and the value of f is the height of the hill or the valley. It's just the height, the elevation. And so minimization in two dimensions is equivalent to you sitting, here you are, you've thought of a value of x, so that means you're sitting at a particular point on the Earth. And here we're ignoring spherical Earth. This is a flat Earth, x1 and x2. We're dealing with that's not important. We just want x1, flat Earth. Here you are, you're sitting on the Earth, a particular location. You want to find the lowest point. So that's the equivalent problem to this minimization problem. This particular minimization problem happens to be very simple, because f is a quadratic form, so it means it's some sort of a nice function like this, whereas, of course, a general earth goes up and down and has a whole bunch of valleys and et cetera, so it's much harder. So this is particularly simple. So this thing here, grad F, is what you, if you're sitting on the Earth and you look for the direction which has the maximum gradient, which goes down fast as possible, that's what grad F is. So if you were sitting at the top of a mountain and you had various choices, you would not get, and you would, so if you are here and you want to get to the, we want to get to the bottom of this valley. So actually, if it was like this, the maximum gradient is just down here. And that would be a pretty reasonable direction to go, because it's straight downhill, whereas, say, this direction, perpendicular to it, would be a stupid direction to go, because you know you're not going to make much progress if you go perpendicular to the direction of maximum gradient. So, the method of steepest descent says, take where you are and find the direction where the gradient is traveling, is going as fast as possible. So that's what. And then it says, minimize it as a function of one variable. So one variable is just how far you walk downhill. So it says, take this as a function of one variable. This one variable goes from here to here and then up again here. So obviously the minimum as a function of one variable is here. And if we write for this particular form, x of k plus 1 of x of k plus alpha r of k, f of alpha becomes a simple quadratic in a single number alpha. It is therefore trivial to find the value of alpha corresponding to here, the bottom of the hill, because we just differentiate f of alpha with respect to alpha. We get a very simple form, which is presumably given here, and it's this funny thing here, RK transpose dotted into RK divided by RK transpose A of RK. So, and you can also do it by completing the square if you wanted to. So, this is a great success. Because it has lots of nice features, we've got a nice formula. The new value of f is guaranteed to be less than the old value of f because you're going downhill. But if you head downhill, you're going to get to a lower point. So that's obviously a good idea. And so this method, which is called the method of steepest descent when applied to optimization, is a good first thing to do. So, I mean, if you were sitting on your hill, that would be a good first thing to do. So this file here points out something which I said already, actually, last time, that conjugate gradient can be applied to any sparse matrix, or in fact, any matrix. It is being described by me in this case of a finite element problem because conjugate gradient effectively comes from a minimization methodology and finite element is a minimization methodology. But that linkage of finite element and conjugate gradient is not rigid. You can do conjugate gradient for a finite difference problem. Perfectly reasonable thing to do. Any reasonable matrix, because I believe conjugate gradient will always work better than Gauss-Seidel or Jacobian. There may be a few pathologies where it doesn't, but in general, you can assume conjugate gradient is a better method than the other methods we discussed. The only methods that will do better than conjugate gradient are these methods like domain decomposition and multigrid, which use so-called preconditioning or other methods to change the problem. Given the problem, solve AX equals B and don't change A or B, conjugate gradient is essentially the best method. Alright. So actually we have to now decide what's wrong with conjugate gradient. So we've got a great first step. You know, we've gone here and we got to here. What's wrong with conjugate gradient, which may not be entirely obvious, but maybe you can go out on a hill and try it out, but it might not be a quadratic hill, so you might not find out what's really wrong, is it's a wonderful first guess, but it's not a terribly good second guess, because it sort of keeps stuck here. It will come here and it will not move from around here. At least if it moves, it will not move properly. So conjugate gradient is fine for going down the initial steep hill, but very bad for going down other directions. Because really, so now I can draw it properly. Well, if I have two hands, you see, it's really like this. It's got one steep hill, which usually there's going to be two principal directions, and one might be steeper than the other. We'll see that intuitively, conjugate gradient does very well on the steep part of the hill, and rather poorly on the shallow part of the hill. But you want the you want the total minimum, you want the absolute minimum, which does properly for both, for all parts of the of the hill. So we can now see this mathematically, and that's what this analysis here does. And so this is why steepest descent is not used as a method of minimization. At least if it is used, it only gets a good first approximation. And we will use eigenvalues. And the reason, of course, we use eigenvalues, we convert a matrix problem into a number problem, it's going to be a lot easier to discuss it. So, we're assuming we have a nice matrix A, which is symmetric, positive, definite, because that's what our del squared phi gives us. That's what our finite element problem for del squared phi gave us. Symmetric matrices can always be diagonalized. If they're positive, definite, or their eigenvalues are positive, let's say they're positive. And so we can always, and A is real, so we can write A in this form, P to the minus 1, which is equal to P transpose, because P is orthogonal. This is the matrix of eigenvectors. A diagonal matrix I called K last time I did this, and is now called lambda. It has it is diagonal with the eigenvalues along the diagonal. And effectively what we do is we transform coordinates so that the coordinates run along the eigenvector directions. So coming back to our two-dimensional case here, the eigenvector directions are this direction and this direction for this particular ball. So they're the principal axes of the ball. So effectively it says, change your coordinate system so they run along the principal axes of this quadratic form, which is always possible. As we pointed out many times, this is only a mathematical analysis because finding eigenvectors takes longer than solving linear equations. So this is not a practical way of solving a particular linear equation. It's a perfectly fine mathematical way of understanding why a particular approach may or may not work. So let me introduce these variables with tildes on them. The variables with tildes on them are just the transform coordinates, and mathematically they're gotten by multiplying the vector p into the original vector. So x tildes is t times x and so on, and b tildes is p times b. So we then transform variables to these tilded things, and we get exactly the same form we got before, except everything has now got a tilde on top of it. And the one nice thing is that our big matrix A becomes a matrix lambda, which is the A in this new coordinate system, which is now a diagonal matrix. So we're going to find it much easier to understand how to solve this problem with a diagonal matrix there than with a non-diagonal matrix there. In fact, the solution is obviously trivial. You just take, if we have a diagonal matrix, the minimum is just gotten by taking the ith component of B tildes and dividing it by lambda I. That is the minimum of the quadratic form. So we will find out the fact that we have to divide by lambda I to be very important. This illustrates extremely well something which I could have illustrated earlier, which is why not only why eigenvalues are important, but why the ratio of the largest eigenvalue to the smallest eigenvalue is important. Because that's called the condition number of the matrix, is the ratio of the largest to the smallest eigenvalue. The reason is that it sort of gives you the scale of the problem, because this formula here shows that the small eigenvalues, when I divide by them, are going to give very large shifts in this coordinate system. And the large eigenvalues are going to give relatively small shifts. So I have to find a numerical formalism that's capable of generating relatively small numbers, b1 over lambda 1, because lambda 1 is the biggest eigenvalue, as well as bn over lambda n, where n, lambda n is the smallest eigenvalue. And as the ratio of lambda max to lambda min goes like 1 over h squared, where h is the grid spacing, this is going to be, these condition numbers typically very, very big. I mean, these are millions. I mean, a typical condition number of a real problem can be tens of thousands to millions to much greater. So the ratio of these eigenvalues is some very big number. And so this file is quite important and a little obscure. So it basically, it starts off at the top by adding tildes to everything. So we found in our steepest ascent a formula for the shift, alpha of k, and it was just r transpose r over r transpose ar. If we go to tildes, we just get a lambda at the bottom. So we get r tildes dotted into r tildes over r tildes lambda r tildes. And the iteration, remember, was taking the kth iterative is the k minus 1 plus alpha of k times the r of k minus 1. I think I used k plus 1 to k before. You can calculate the new residual. If you calculate the new residual, you will find that the new residual is 1 minus alpha k times lambda times the k minus 1 residual. So where lambda's here is a matrix. And so you can now calculate components based on that. So this has got a little too many indices to be easy to understand. But let's think what we want to do. If we go into components, it basically says the ith component of the residual is multiplied by 1 minus alpha k times the ith eigenvalue. So let's sort of think about that in a little bit. So so the simplest case to think about, which can easily be generalized, is the case where there is one big eigenvalue, lambda 1, and all the other eigenvalues are quite a bit smaller. If you have several big ones, it's fine. But if, let's suppose 1 is big. So if 1 is big, then the formula for alpha of k is the sum of these residuals divided by the lambda times the residuals. In general, the residuals will all have, each residual will have the same typical size. So if one lambda is much bigger than the others, this term here, this alpha of k, just actually becomes roughly 1 over lambda 1, because this lambda I just stamps out all the contributions are the residuals which are not near I equals 1. So what you end up with a formula is, so you have an alpha which goes like 1 over lambda 1. So actually maybe we can go back to the previous formula. So we're multiplying the ith residual by 1 minus alpha k over times lambda I. So if alpha k is roughly 1 over the maximum eigenvalue, that sort of illustrates the problem with this method. Namely, it's done a wonderful job for I equals 1, because it's got 1 minus lambda 1 over lambda 1, so that's a pretty good idea. But if lambda I is small, it's done essentially nothing, because it's taken lambda I, which is a small number, divided by lambda max, which is a big number. Remember I said lambda min over lambda max goes like h squared, where h is the grid spacing, which is sort of 10 to the minus 6. So all this has managed to do for the small, for the values of I corresponding to the small eigenvalues is multiplied by 0.99999 with 5 nines or something. So that's not a very good idea. So this is what I was trying to illustrate on this thing which is meant to become a VRML applet. That what happens is you get jammed into the same spot, because you diligently come down the slope, and as you keep applying the method, it still actually gets smaller and smaller, but by tiny and tiny amounts, because you're diligently multiplying the residuals in the small directions by a number which is rigorously less than 1, but only just less than 1, by this thing 1 minus lambda I over lambda 1. So we deduce from this that we have a wonderful method for the high eigenvalues and a terrible method for the small eigenvalues. Now, this is actually totally consistent with our previous discussion of other iterative methods. Because you may remember we discussed that for Jacobi or Gauss-Seidel, we had a matrix, we talked about eigenvalues of that matrix, and we said those eigenvalues corresponded to rapidly varying terms and slowly varying terms. And the iterative method did rapidly varying terms very well and did absolutely nothing for the slowly varying terms. So there's a little bit of a confusion, because when I talked about that, I claimed that the small eigenvalues were the ones that worked well and the large eigenvalues were the ones that worked badly for Jacobi. The reason for that is that I was talking about a different matrix. I was talking about the iteration matrix, which is 1 minus the original matrix. So it turns out that this statement is entirely equivalent. Conjugate gradient, where I happen to discuss the eigenvalues of the full matrix, does wonderfully for the big eigenvalues and very badly for the small eigenvalues. That's entirely equivalent to Jacobi doing wonderfully for the rapid oscillations and very badly for the slow oscillations. I happen to discuss it in terms of eigenvalues, which just effectively differed by a constant diagonal element, which was just translated small to large and large to small. So this statement about, so we found out from this optimization approach and hill climbing exactly the same statement. These iterative methods, if you're not careful, only do well on rapid oscillations and do very badly on the slowly varying terms. So that's what that says. All right. So, Herbring Canton just wrote a note on conjugal gradients, because if you read all mathematical textbooks, they now present the answer without giving you a good reason as to why it's the answer. So the purpose of my discussion here and Herbring's note is to try to give you more intuition as to why the, what the answer is trying to do. So what is the basic idea of conjugal gradients? So the basic idea is, well, the normal steepest ascent gets stuck here. So obviously, it's obvious what I ought to do. I ought to just go in perpendicular direction. So what's perpendicular? That's what the word conjugant means. So the idea of the conjugal gradient is, well, we have a nifty first guess. If I apply that first guess on an ongoing fashion, I get nowhere because I keep refining in the same direction, which is a bad idea. I do not wish to make R1 better and better because it's already perfect. So what I do is I just insist that the second move is perpendicular to R1, and therefore it will get rid of R2, roughly. And then the third one I make perpendicular to R1 and R2, and it gets rid of R3. So this shows you, this then suggests that with conjugal gradient, I can find a method that rigorously converges in n steps, because if I choose n orthogonal vectors, I've done each direction, and at each step it's going to make a lot of progress, because what it's doing, it's done the convergence, if you like, in one subspace, the most rapidly varying. It then goes to the conjugate subspace, goes to the steepest ascent in that conjugate subspace, which it does very well at, and then it goes, then it just eliminates that one as having done it great well, and keeps on going on. And so it effectively, so in this method, in this two-dimensional world, it does it in two steps. It goes down here, and then the minimum in this valley where we see the valley. I've drawn it. The reason I've got this ball with a very sharp direction, a very shallow direction. This is a large eigenvalue. The shallow direction is a small eigenvalue. And it's meant to illustrate that the problem is I do the large eigenvalue well, I do very badly in the small eigenvalue. That's what this analysis said. But the conjugal gradient carefully chooses a step which is orthogonal or conjugant to the large eigenvalue direction, and therefore it does get corrected the small eigenvalue, because you see the difficulty is that the large eigenvalues contaminate the small eigenvalues. If I could just delete those rows and columns of the matrix corresponding to the large eigenvalues, everything is perfect. So that's effectively what the method is doing. Now, it's not quite doing that, and it's certainly not explicitly doing it, because we can't find eigenvalues and eigenvectors, because that's too expensive. Historically, the reason I tend to explain it this way, when I was, your age or maybe a little bit older, I spent most of my time fitting various theoretical formulae to various pieces of experimental data. And the method I actually used mostly was to take these formulae like these and actually find the eigenvalues and eigenvectors and do the optimization by precisely this method of moving along the large eigenvalues separately from the small eigenvalues. I could do that in the case of optimization, because in optimization the formulae for the matrix elements is extremely complicated, and solving the matrix took me negligible time, so I could afford to find eigenvalues and eigenvectors. However, in a typical PDE or the finite element method, forming the matrix is sort of trivial. It's just adding a few numbers together, and so I have to have an extremely fast solver to go along with that. And so in other applications, you can find eigenvalues, and I believe that that's actually a very effective way of solving it. Where your matrix where you're finding your matrix is very expensive, then you can use this method, and that's what I found quite effective. All right. So those long words are basically explained here. It says that We have a serious problem because lambda n over lambda 1 is h squared, where h is a grid spacing or of order h squared. That's a typical condition number. Well, the condition number is 1 over h squared, the ratio of the largest to the smallest. Lambda n over lambda 1 is the smallest to the largest. And we're going to choose an iteration method where x of 1 is calculated in terms of x of 0 by steepest descent, but x of k is calculated in terms of x of k minus 1 for later k by a choice where we do not use the naive steepest descent as the vector. So we're still going to use the same idea. Choose a vector, minimize as a function of a single number multiplying that vector. That's the basic steepest descent idea. But we're going to choose the vector to be the residual with all its components with respect to the previous directions eliminated. So that's what this equation at the bottom says. That is, that we choose it orthogonal to the previous direction. And it's not so obvious. If you choose it orthogonal to the previous direction, it ends up being orthogonal to all previous directions, which I don't believe is obvious. So what is the difference, therefore, between So this formula, this page here, so if we were mathematicians, we wouldn't have done all this stuff about optimization and Poisson continuous gradient. We would have gone straight to this page here. Because this page here is entirely sufficient to do the continuous gradient. My only problem with this page is it's not quite so obvious why the formula is what it is. Well, say for Jacobi or Gauss-Seidel, I would use the iteration as sort of relatively obvious and intuitive what it's doing. I do not view it as entirely intuitive what these equations are doing. So what does it say? So if we look at the second equation, it says, having calculated the zeroth residual, which is the steepest descent direction, we set the direction P1, which we're going to minimize along for the first step, to be the true steepest descent. In general, we set the kth direction for minimizing along to be the kth minus 1 residual, which is the steepest descent direction at the kth minus 1 step, plus a correction, which correction is added on to make this direction orthogonal to the previous direction. So we're just subtracting out the components. See, P of k minus 1 is the previous direction we stepped along. So we're taking away, see, we want to, in this thing here, we want to go, we don't want to keep heading in this direction, we want to subtract off that component and head in that direction. So this theta of k times the k minus 1 direction is precisely, we're going to choose beta of k to subtract off any component the k minus 1 residual has along the previous direction of minimization. P of k minus 1 was the previous direction we used. Because we're doing P of 1, P of 2, we go along P1, then we go along P2, then we go along P3, and these are effectively orthogonal directions in our n-dimensional space. And we're going to we end up choosing n orthogonal directions, because there are n orthogonal directions in the n-dimensional space, and they're all mutually orthogonal with respect to this metric A. And this is a method for choosing them. All right. So, you can calculate how to subtract off that component, and that formula is given here. It's P of k minus transpose of times A times R of k minus 1 over P of k minus 1 transpose A of P of k minus 1. So we have a formula for P of k in terms of in terms of the current residual and the previous shift direction. Now we have a quadratic formula for alpha of k. We can solve that quadratic formula with exactly the same formula, because that doesn't care whether p of k replaces r of k or not. So alpha of k is just pk transpose pk over pk transpose apk, And so then we said x of k is at x of k minus 1 plus alpha of k pk, and r of k is b minus a of x of k. So that's the formula. So this page is the conjugate gradient method. Now, it takes n steps. Unlike for Jacobi iteration, it does not converge exactly after any number of steps. It gets better and better, and we estimated that it had needed n squared steps to be acceptable. But, if you have a certain multiple of n squared steps, you get 10 to the minus 3 accuracy. If you have another multiple, you'll get 10 to the minus 6 accuracy. So you'll never get zero rigorously. Conjugate gradient, if you have no rounding error, will rigorously give you the right answer, because it's guaranteed to converge after n steps. However, you don't necessarily need to use n steps, because you may find that the residual is quite small after a much smaller number of n steps than n steps. So conjugate gradient is guaranteed to converge in n, but actually can give totally acceptable answers after much smaller than n steps. And you would use a standard criterion for choosing to stop it. So, I also forgot to mention on the last FOIL that I define a so-called stationary method to be one where the matrix is the same at each iteration, and Gauss, Seidel, and Jacobi were stationary. It's relatively clear that effectively the iteration matrix is different at each step of Gauss, Seidel, because I'm dynamically choosing the step direction. So conjugate gradient is not a stationary method. Yes? Sorry? Well, the answer is that, so that we have to now think what we're doing. When we discuss optimization is defined over any function f. It turns out it reduces, the way you do optimization is you do a Taylor expansion about your current guess, about which f then becomes quadratic, and you use effectively this method of the quadratic assumption, quadratic approximation. For the finite element method, the function f is rigorously quadratic, and therefore it will not go corrugated. Whereas a real function, you know, when I was doing these complicated optimizations of peculiar functions which had exponentials and logs and integrals and obscure things in it, they were certainly not quadratic, exactly. So your comment that conjugate gradient doesn't work in a ragged landscape is totally correct. You need to supplement conjugate gradient with some method to get near the minimum. So that's a long discussion which is non-trivial, but it is true that what you do when you do optimization is effectively, you know, in optimization the world consists of a bunch, you know, of lovely valleys. You know, this is sort of the Garden of Eden. So every now and then you have a bunch of valleys, and you have to find the right valley. Once you've got to the valley which has the Garden of Eden, then you use conjugate gradient to find the tree of truth or whatever you're looking for at the bottom of the garden. And of course, if you find the wrong valley, you'll find the devil or something that will gobble you up or something at the minimum. But the strategy in optimization then is to find a methodology for finding the right valley. Once you've found the right valley, then you use conjugate gradient or some comparable method. In the case of finite elements, the formula is rigorously quadratic. Therefore, you do not need this first step. art. So, anyway, so conjugate gradient. Where are we? Did we say this? Blah, 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 blah. Yes. All right, so let's now discuss parallelism. And parallelism in conjugate gradient and parallelism in finite elements, which is rather mixed up in this discussion, are basically similar to everything we've done up to now, except a little more complicated. They have the same type of issues of locality, communication of a computation, etc., but they're just not quite as elegant or simple as they are for finite difference. And we need to look at the parallelism in two parts of the problem. One is the problem of calculating the matrix elements. The second is in solving the equations. Because in finite difference, the calculation of the matrix elements is itself trivially parallel, because each, when we do our standard geometric decomposition, each processor can calculate effectively the matrix elements trivially. It does not have to worry about calculating the matrix elements. In the case of finite elements, the matrix elements are these, comes from these triangles that formally depend on the details of the triangles, but so calculating the matrix elements requires communication and a little bit of thought, which is not present for finite difference. We will then, then if we look at this formula, if we look at, say, back to the equation for the full conjugate gradient algorithm, we will see two types of things we have to do. One is so-called matrix vector products, A times R, A times P. So these are called matrix vector products. So the matrix is this matrix A, and the vector is one of these vectors defined at the nodal points, because everything starts off defined, labeled by nodal points. So those are the, here are called X, originally they were called P. So we have R and X and P all defined at the nodal points, and we have to multiply by the vector X. So what is Xij times Aij times Xj? Well, that's discussed actually a little later on, but it's effectively a local a nearest neighbor type computation, because Aij is this sparse matrix which is only non-zero when I and j are actually on the an edge of a triangle. So Aij Xj is very similar to what we did in Jacobi iteration, which linked nearest neighbor points together. The other things we have to do are so-called scalar products, Xj, Yj, like this thing called beta of k, is P of k minus 1 transposed, dotted into the matrix vector product A times R. So Xj, Yj runs over all j, and so it's going to be a so-called global sum. When people discuss conjugate gradient, they seem to sometimes be in terror of global sums. As far as I know, there is no reason to be in terror of global sums, because we saw those in, we effectively had these global parts of Jacobi iteration, because when we calculated the error condition, that was a global sum. We calculated the global, the maximum value of the change all over the entire domain. That was effectively one of these collective global computations, and whether what you're calculating is a sum or a global maximum, makes a little difference to the actual computational analysis. All right. So we go to the next file. We will see that the first statement is sort of simple. It says, the way you do parallelism in finite elements in exactly the same way we've always done it. We do a geometrical decomposition. So here we have these are nodal points, and these are processes domains. Because in general the geometry is not simple, there's no particularly general simple way of assigning processes to parts of the geometry. And there's a lot of work on load balancing which investigates best ways of doing that. But roughly what you're going to do is just as you did for finite difference. You're going to take your geometrical domain over which your nodal points are defined. You're going to chop it up into parts. You're going to choose those parts so there are going to be equal number of nodal points in each part. And that will ensure, and you're going to try to do it so each of these parts has small surface area, so you minimize communication, because communication is a surface effect. And we have equal number of points to keep make the computational work the same. So there are some, technically, because everything is irregular geometries, both the processor domains and the original array of triangles, it is not quite as clean and elegant as finite difference, but the essential idea is the same. So in this picture here, so here we have four nodal points, so we might have drawn the triangle, so maybe this was two triangles where this is an edge, either this or this, let's choose this one. So that would say that this point here will be joined to the processor to its left and to the processor below it. And it would need to work with these processors in both in calculating the matrix elements and in invoking the appropriate values of xi. So this is I, xj, xj1 and xj2, which this point is linked to. It might be linked to other points, which could be over here, again in another processor, or they could be internal to this processor. So because the geometry is irregular, there's not such a clean statement as which points are linked to which others. So you need sort of linked lists and more complicated data structures to keep track of all this. And there are various ways of doing it. So I believe, apart from a little bit of pointers and some suitable indirection, this is essentially the same as finite difference. It has all the same properties. Local, the formula for communication overhead goes like 1 over nodal points to the half in 2 dimensions, 1 over nodal points to the 1/3 in 3 dimensions, because it's a surface effect. And the range of the force, the range of the interaction is roughly 1, just the distance between two neighboring points. And we said our triangles had to be nicely shaped. They couldn't be long and skinny. So that says that, you know, these are only factors of 2 in various... I mean, it's not truly the nearest neighbor, because we can have triangles that aren't exactly the nearest points, but they're going to be roughly that. So there's the qualitative discussion is identical. The numerical coefficient might be a little different. And I say the technology for doing this is much more complicated. I mean, your code is going to look more complex. But you can still do it by the same type of method with guard rings. They're going to be guard nodal points and stuff like that. So you can bring in all the nodal points, put them in so that you can then effectively calculate the conventional sequential finite element method in each processor. And again, this foil here, the scalar product foil, one says scalar products in parallel conjugate gradient. And the first bullet notes that we are, of course, using the owner computes rule. So we're going to compute everything associated with x of I in the processor that owns nodal point I. So x of I is going to have, the ith nodal point needs to know about aij xj, where xj is either the original x or some function like the residual calculated from it. And so we're going to have to, as we do with Jacobi, send all points linked to I to the processor that owns I. So that's this nearest neighbor local communication. We have these global sums. They're just done like this global maximum in Jacobi. To do a global sum, you calculate, each processor diligently calculates the component of the sum in each processor. We have sum over all possible points yj, xj. We do that by calculating yj, xj in each processor. So you get a single number from each processor. Then you just do a nifty algorithm to calculate the global sum, which there are some various clever methods for, and it takes a short time. So this is called combine. Notice all these things are primitives in both MPI and HPF, these global collective operations are supported both in the intrinsics in HPF and in the collective communication routines of MPI. So this is an example of why you like collective communication, because hopefully MPI has, remember there was we had the MPI had a collective communication where the result of the global sum was delivered to all processors. This is precisely an example where you'd want to deliver to all processors, because all processors need to know these global scalar products. It's not an example of a case where you're making a single decision in one processor to say yes or no, where you may want the global sum or the global max in one processor. For the conjugate gradient, every nodal point must use these global sums to calculate the shifts. It turns out that's not a problem, because on most architectures, it takes no longer to calculate the global sum and send it to all processors as the global sum and send it to one processor. And the qualitative is described in, say, my early books or in other articles. The reason is, even if you send it to one processor, the other processors aren't doing anything after most of the time, and you can use that to just gather, for them to gather their copy of the global sum. If you look at the communication overhead for these global operations, you will find it's negligible, at least mathematically, maybe not in practice, but formally it's negligible. Because although it's global, global sums can typically be done in logarithmic time. The number of global scalar products is a few. I don't know how many there are. Maybe there are two or three. So two or three multiplied by a logarithm of the number of processes is small compared to the square, to the typical gains you get in communication due to edge over area effects. So this is small compared to the small compared to the local communication, as long as you implement it properly with efficient algorithms. So this finishes the discussion of parallelism in conjugate gradient, which says that it's too complicated to set in a class like this, but the basic ideas that you have done in this class with Jacobi iteration do apply to conjugate gradients. So when you go out in the real world and Boeing asks you to see if their latest Joint Strike Fighter is going to break apart, that's what McDonnell Douglas says it does, you will know how to solve it. In fact, if you work for McDonnell Douglas, you might have a strong motivation for knowing it. Side that this plane, this novel new plane, might fall apart or something. Anyway, but that's all right. The last two foils, which you might as well finish. Actually, we've effectively said these points already. So this effectively finishes the discussion of sparse matrix algorithms. And one area which is very important, which we've not discussed, is effectively preconditioning, which we wrote down mathematically right at the beginning, which effectively changes the matrix M. And you can sort of now see well, we change the matrix A to a matrix M, and so why do we do that? So we've sort of seen what the problem is. Convergence of iterative methods is proportional to lambda max, lambda min over lambda max. So the goal, if you like, the mathematical goal is to reduce lambda min over lambda max, which is to improve, as lambda max over lambda min is the condition number, is to reduce the condition number, or which is why it's called preconditioning. We're trying to choose a transformation which makes the ratio of the smallest to largest eigenvalues smaller. And there are various ways of doing that which tend to be motivated by physical ideas, of which multigrid and related algorithms are the best, probably. At least they're the most naturally the best. So the final foil makes a few comments on the convergence of conjugal gradients. It says that the convergence of a conjugal gradient method goes like lambda max, the square root of lambda max over lambda min, whereas Jacobi goes like lambda max over lambda min. So this is, this can be hundreds of times better, because lambda max over lambda min can be 10 to the 6, or at least say 10 to the 4. The square root of that is then 100 to 1,000. So the number of iterations in conjugal gradient is strikingly better than the Gauss-Seidel. We got a similar formula for SOR. But SOR, you had to choose the relaxation parameter omega optimally to get the right answer. For conjugal gradient, at least for decent problems, you're guaranteed this good convergence. It should be noticed that the conjugal gradient iterations are computationally more expensive by some non-trivial factor. I don't know what it is. Maybe 5 to 10. So there's more arithmetic per iteration. So for very small matrices, Jacobi will win. But for any decent-sized matrix, or decently small grid size, so that 1 over H is reasonably big, the conjugal gradient will always win. So that's sort of the end of sparse matrices. So I think what I'm going to do in the last lecture, I'm going to make up a new lecture summarizing some of these things we haven't done, like fast multiple methods and libraries and stuff like that, and sort of make it a survey of issues in parallel computing. So I'll be here for a while. If anybody wants to talk to me about that project, I'd be happy to talk to them. You sent me email, isn't that right? So your project was fine. Thank you.